Creation, Day 6. The passage, and I'd like to read it with you. We'll get into the individual parts as we go. But take it in, 24 to 31. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle, and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind, and it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, cattle after their kind, everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply. Replenish the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth or creepeth upon the earth. And God said, Behold, speaking to man, I have given you every herb bearing seed, seeding seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed," again, seeding seed, "to you it shall be for meat, for food. And so every beast of the earth, to every fowl of the air, to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, wherein there is a living soul, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were," the morning was, "the sixth day." Well, an exciting conclusion to the 6 days. God created land animals. And we see the verse that we've read. He did it, he said it, and it happened. We see that it was creation with the power of reproduction. Let the earth bring forth a creature, living creature after his kind. Again, the word God is Elohim. This is the word speaking of God as the powerful one. Plural word. We can recognize as reflecting the truth of the Trinity, of the triunity. And the word said is also translated elsewhere as commanded. So this is the word, he's speaking a word that is going to happen. And then it says, and it was so. Bring forth, we found in the creation of the water animals that the word there just meant that the water began to swarm. Nothing was being brought forth from the water, or by the water, or out of the water. It was just swarming. This, however, bring forth, is the verb to cause to go, or to cause to come out, to bring out, or to bring out of, to lead out. So I think that we have here the indication that God formed the bodies of the animals from the earth, as he would later form man. Living creature is literally living soul. Last time, I believe it was, we talked about the use of the word soul. And while it is used in the most general concept of that which is alive, it is also used in the very specific thing of the soul within man. Here he infused that body made from the earth with the principle of life. After his kind pictures the capability within the animals to reproduce their own type of animal. Today's concept of species, the scientific concept, if you look it up, it's rather an arbitrary designation that's usually far more restrictive than what God intends here. For instance, probably God only created only one kind of dog. not just one dog, of course, but a pair of dogs. And but the idea is that over the years, these things then have been bred by different characteristics to make them big dogs, small dogs, that type of thing. But he may have had other things in mind. I've always been amazed at the various types of animals that he makes. We'll talk about this in a moment, about the creation of cattle. But by contrast, evolution says that these things were not made according to their kind. It's just that it's all emerging. The strange thing, the thing that's unexplained, they talk about it, but they don't explain it, is why, for every evidence that we have of animals, is that there's always been dogs, there's always been cats, there's always been these animals, always been the cockroach. These are settled kinds. Why? If it's all just emerging, why is there one set form settled on it, see? Pastor Porter was telling me about a book he read, a fantasy book, where evolution was true. I don't know that the man was anti-evolution. He was just writing about it. But in his world, there was no such thing as a dog or a lion or a bear. It was just like kind of a quadruped, a four-footed animal that was of greater or lesser size. You know, these things are just emerging, just changing, all developing. Why has mankind looked the same since all recorded history? We have the fossils. We have all the things about mankind. They look like man. Why doesn't he look different? Why isn't he emerging? Why don't we have various forms of man, you know? Third eye developing, better location device, larger ears to hear better, my sweetie. Who knows, what locks it into this position? This is the way God created it. Secondly, we notice that he creates the creation of cattle. This is Strong's word 929, behemoth. Part of that we find in behemoth later in the book of Job. But God uses this word to refer to animals in general, but of flock animals in particular. So when they would gather together their flocks and move, this is the word that he used, that they took their animals with them. They weren't taking lions and tigers and bears, oh no. They were taking their flock animals. So we are justified, I think, in seeing this designation that this is the domestic animals. He created the domestic animals. It's been amazing to me to realize, like talking about dogs, the shepherding dogs, the border collies, all these things. I don't know if you realize this, you don't need to teach these dogs to do this. You have to teach them what they're to do or how to do it with this particular thing. But just let them loose untrained and they start gathering these animals together. They're herding animals. Why? this is a helper to man who is raising sheep or cows or whatever. God built this within them. The domestic animals were created. I don't know about dolphins, whether they're considered domestic or not, but my wife and I were interested to notice that we were taken out on a boat trip in Florida, where often dolphins, and we found them together doing this diving out of the water and going back in. I thought they had to be trained for this, but they should do this. It's just fun. What's going on up there? Let me visit this world of the air, you know. And but the amazing thing to me is that the stories of seamen lost at sea, the ship sinking, they're in flotation devices or bits of debris or whatever, and the sharks start coming over and over and over again. I've heard these stories of the dolphins that come and fight off the sharks protecting the men. You know, how do you explain something like that? How did that evolve? These are, and perhaps they're domestic animals, I don't know. But God did this with the concept of being a help to man, being sustenance, later being the wool, things like that, for man. Then the creation of creeping things, that says it, creeping. The Strong's 7431 Remes, God uses this word for any animal that moves. The creeping is not necessarily creepy creeping, but moving, but especially all of the smaller creatures, and it's often used of things like insects. The psalmist, however, includes the water animals, Psalm 104:25. So is this great and wide sea wherein are things creeping, this is the word, innumerable, both small and great beasts. So moving animals, even here within the sea, this word is particularly talking about that. So we're looking at moving things, but often the smaller creeping things. And then the creation of beasts and beast of the earth. This is Strong's 24:16. Hey, I've noticed part of the passage we were looking at in Deuteronomy this morning actually uses this word, because it's used for anything that's alive. When he promises that he will give them life, this was the word that he used. But in Genesis 2:9, God used this word for the tree of life, the tree of Chay. So I think in this list, you have the domestic, you have the little creepy things. So I think in this list, it seems to indicate the remaining forms of animals, the wild beasts. It's my conclusion, but it's not that this never used like this. In Genesis 37:20, this word is used when the evil brother is talking about Joseph. Come now, therefore, let us slay him, cast him into some pit. We will say some evil beast hath devoured him. This was not a ranging sheep. You know, this was some wild animal that they could blame it on. We shall see what will become of his dreams, mocking evil men. So he creates it, and with these varying categories, as well as keeping them within their kinds, he creates it, and the creation was satisfactory. And God saw that it was good. This was what he wanted. This was what he planned. This is what he intended. And everything that he had said, it was so. We find a departure now. All before, God said, and it was so. Now we find a departure. So my second point is this: God conferred with himself before making man in his image. We find something new here. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, over the earth, over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. He proposes to himself, let us do this. You know, it's so easy to put human feelings and stuff into God, who is so transcendent. We have difficulty running after and grasping that concept. But it's like looking, you know, God the Father looking at the Son and the Spirit saying, well, only one thing left. The whole reason we started this, as you know, mankind. And since we live outside of time, we know exactly what he's going to do. We know what it's going to take to finally bring him to ourselves. I imagine him looking at Jesus saying, you know what this is going to mean for you? Looking at the Holy Spirit, and you know what this is going to mean for you? Keeping your spirit form, but inhabiting every believer for as long as they live, you're going to be very busy. What do you think? Let us do this. You see that confirming nod or whatever Holy Spirits do. And let's do this. So he made them after the image of God. Oh, what is this? The image of God. God uses this word for image in a general sense. Things made in another likeness, something that looks like something else. He uses it directly after this passage. He uses it several times in this passage. But after this, he only uses it once in the whole Bible. Speaking of the image of God, Genesis 9:6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. The murderer shall be killed. For in the image of God made he man. Now this is, quite a bit later. It's after the flood, after Noah's flood. But the recognition of how God made man is the reason that man is separate from animals, plants, everything else. That taking his life is condemned by death itself because of this. The word likeness is also generic. God uses the word of man's likeness to himself only once more, Genesis 5:1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. This is the only time this is used. We don't find vast uses of this phrase, made in the image of God, made in the likeness of God. It's perhaps because of this that through the ages, in all of theological history, man has never settled the debate about the image of God, at least not to my satisfaction. It's clearly not a physical image. Calvin, I think, was the first one I read that argued, well, because God knew how he wanted to make Christ, he took that image and made man like that after the image of what Christ was going to be. But this is backward thinking, it seems to me, because Christ became a man. It wasn't that man became Christ-like. It's wrong thinking. In the mind of God, perhaps there was something about that, I don't know. But it's clearly, to me, not a physical image, because God is without a physical body. You can't match that. The old theologians seem to be satisfied to speak of man's moral and mental likeness to God. I took that phrase from one of the explanations of what the image of God was. The main problem that I have with this is that the angels also have a high degree of likeness to God, but they are not said to share the image of God. This undoes a lot of what I read about what it means about the image of God. We find that God refers to fallen man as still in the image of God. This is not to say that he's in perfect condition. You've seen great old pagan temples, for instance, fallen into ruin, but you can picture the Angkor Wat and some of these other wonderful places. You see the grandness of the structure that they made, kind of hinting through the great roots and things built up. But fallen man is seen as in the image of God. Again, Genesis 9:6, for who sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. At least he's referring to post fallen man. 1 Corinthians 11:7, for a man indeed ought not to cover his head. You've seen the Jewish yarmulkes, the men always covering their heads. Paul says about Christian service, don't cover your head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. So it wasn't wrong for her to cover her head and perhaps to cover it with the long hair. But he is in the image. He is the image and glory of God. Not just was made, but is. And James 3:9, therewith we bless we God, even the Father, and therewith we curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. There's a third word, image, likeness, and now similitude. But the idea here is that he says we're talking about something made in the image of God, and we curse man while we're blessing God. This is a double standard of the tongue, see. Pastor Porter and I were talking about this. I go to him with these analytical questions. We were talking about it. And I thought the best concept that came out of the discussion was, I've heard a lot of things. Like, God gave man work to do, and God was working, creating. So he was like God. I thought that was pretty slim connection there. But what is the distinction of mankind? It seems to us that perhaps the essence of man's image of God lies somewhere in the fact that at his creation, God intended man alone to share in God's family, to become sons of God. Now, the angels are called sons of God, but that could refer just to being born of God because of their creation. But we don't read anything of them being a part of the bride of Christ or the family of God or the sons of God and inheriting the inheritance. All these things are just of saved humanity. And that seems to me to be a distinction. Pastor Porter's comment was it's not so much in his creation as in his position. And I like that concept. Perhaps that's it. Probably haven't settled it for everybody for all of time to come. But I do think that it is reinforced, that idea that the sonship of man is the idea of this image, because we recognize that Jesus is also called the image of God. 2 Corinthians 4:4, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. Again in Colossians 1:15, who, speaking of Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. And again in Hebrews 1:3, who being the brightness of his glory, Christ being the brightness of the Father's glory, and the express image of his person, and so on. You say, well, of course, he was the image of God. But you see, we are called as Christians to be conformed to his image, and that revealing the sonship. Our salvation involves becoming like Jesus to be in his family. I remember when it first dawned on me that Romans 8:29 speaks of this sonship, this family relationship, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his son. Why? That he might be the firstborn among many brethren, you see. This is the gathering of us to him as brothers, part of the family, to be called sons of God, even as Christ is called Son of God. So this may be the emphasis that we have been looking for, that the image of God is that which allows man to be taken to the very family of God for all eternity. But something else that I think is often dismissed here, or underestimated at least, is the dominion of man. The dominion of man. It's right there. Let them have dominion over all the other creatures, fish of the sea, fowl of the air, cattle, over all the earth, over a creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. Notice that little phrase in the middle, over all the earth. That's a little separate from all these categories of animals. Dominion, here the Hebrew word is Strong's 7287, rada, is just to mean to rule. Let him rule. Let him rule the earth. I have this sneaking feeling that Satan's animosity to man and his desire to create a replacement for Christ, it seems to me that we can actually look in the old verses about Christ, Satan's rebellion. He was a good angel. He was created highest and brightest and top of the line guy. But the indication is that he was seeking higher. There's a phrase that's used of the Messiah about the sides of the north and so on that is used of what Satan was aspiring to. And I'm not sure what that means, but I do think that he would like to be the one ruling it all. That sounds like him to me. And in this, he has a hatred for man because God put him in charge of the earth with this creation. And Satan's attitude was, we'll see about that. let's see what I can do about that. We find this Hebrews 2:7, thou madest him, mankind, a little lower than the angels. Thou crownest him with glory and honor, there at the creation, and did set him over the works of thy hands. The Hebrew word that we were looking at, to rule, is the same word that's used of the coming Messiah's reign on earth. In Psalm 110:2, the Lord shall send the rod of his strength out of Zion, rule thou. The psalmist says to the Messiah, rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. This is that word. So what Christ will be doing, mankind was doing at the creation. This is a big deal. This is the concept of God's kingdom right from the beginning. This was his way of doing it. Now, fast forward a little bit to the sin and the fall, and therefore the disqualification of him as the mediatorial ruler under God. See, God is giving him the authority. So it's God who is the authority, giving him the authority as a sub-ruler under him. The mediatorial ruler. But with sin and his separation from God, he became disqualified. Now, fast forward a little further to the end of the world. Christ returns and sets up his kingdom. But Christ does this as in his human body. It's a human sitting upon the throne, as was intended at the beginning. This is a vast concept, the restoration of everything as it should have been. And why do we find the animals being at peace with each other like they were in the Garden of Eden? Why all these things happening in the kingdom? Because this is the way God intended it in the first place. When Christ comes to rule and reign. Now, obviously, and some have tried to indicate that man is the ruler, you know. Well, we were looking at Hebrews 2:7. Let's look at Hebrews 2:8. Thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he hath put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now, at this time, we see not yet all things put under him. Now, this would refer to mankind, but also to Jesus Christ as the man, because that's the subject of his topic here. But he's not ruling yet, and mankind is not ruling now. So Christ coming to reign on earth is more than just your particular view of millennial or amillennial or whatever. This is the grand fulfillment of God's original intention for human dominion. We find also that God created mankind to reproduce, and here's that horrible phrase, fill the earth. Oh no, overpopulation, overcrowding, the terrible thing that the earth is facing. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God created he him, made him male and female, created he them. God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish. The word means fill, not refill, but just fill the earth. Subdue it. How dare man do that? That was a command from the beginning. Subdue the earth. Bring it under your control. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the fowl of the air, over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So this is the summary statement of the creation of mankind. And God announces that he made both man and woman in his image. There has been such a male dominance in so many of these past history things that woman, at one point in the Greek philosophy, woman was, they didn't believe in an evolution of things getting better. That it started out with the creation of man and then began to devolve. And this Greek philosopher said the first step down was woman. You see that? Well, this is not the way God thinks. There are jobs that God has given to man that he doesn't give to the woman. There's jobs that he's given to woman that he doesn't give to man. And but in this, both man and woman were made in his image. And because the woman was taken from the side of man, that shows that in this, they are equal. Somebody has said that maybe the whole reason for pointing out that she came from the side was to say, not from his head to dominate him, not from his feet to be walked under his feet, but to walk side by side. Perhaps that's part of the reason. Now, he uses the phrase created here. This is that Hebrew word bara, which we've looked at before, and it indicates a creation from nothing. In the phrase, created man in his own image, then he says, in the image of God created he him, male and female, created he them. Three times the word created. The first time, it is in the imperfect, indicating his ongoing work that he's in the midst of because he hasn't finished with woman yet. But the second and third uses are in the perfect, and these indicate completion, that when he was done, and that the creation from nothing was done. So the body formed from the earth, and the woman's body formed from part and parcel, flesh and bone of the man, they were created as he made them human beings. Today, this also makes them entirely separate from what has already been made, the animal world. Today we see this distinction being minimized and even eliminated, that man is just an animal, and a lot of the animals are a lot better than man, you know. Over and over again, you find that what's the big problem with the earth? Man. What's the solution? I've noticed that, strangely, in some of the thriller shows that you watch or books you read, you find that somebody takes this seriously and decides this is the time to wipe out mankind and save the planet. How twisted is this from God's point of view? That it was made for man, for him to subdue, for him to rule. The animals were important for man. That's why God created them. At first, before he was eating them, at first to help in his work in agriculture. I think of the dogs, and you know, the sheep or animals made to make clothing, whatever. But after the flood, then they were to be for food as well, and that was all set up ahead of time. God understood it all. But the animals were important for man, but not man for the animals. I noticed that God does not mention putting the fear of man into the animals until after the flood. I think this might be because when God gave both man and animals the ability to eat meat, and I say ability because it wasn't a moral thing with the animals. They were choosing to eat what they hungered for. And God changed that after the flood. They started eating flesh as well as man. But at the creation, before that was done, no animal had the desire to eat man. So he didn't need to fear man. He was just another thing that was there. And therefore, man had no fear of them. I find this to be interestingly different from what we're hearing from the world's people today. With all of the historical warnings about overpopulation, we might find ourselves surprised to realize that this command to fill the earth has not been fulfilled yet. Man is pretty much everywhere around the world, but he's not filled it up. And this is not something that we need to fear. This is not the end of the world. This is not the end of all things. Somebody was saying some years ago that Jacksonville, Florida is this huge area, the actual city limits. It's a huge area. And statistically, you could take every human being on the planet, give them a spot where they could stand there, not touching anybody else, and everybody would fit in Jacksonville. Might have to move some buildings. I'm not sure. But within the city limits, there would be room to put everybody there. I mean, you talk about the crowd. You know who's talking about. They always show some crowded area in India where people are just standing on each other and stuff like this. Well, give me a shot of Wyoming. Look far and wide. You don't see a person, you know. Travel through those areas out west, you know. The earth is not filled. And there's an interesting thing that happens that all these people worrying about all this never understand. And that is, as man fills the earth, he develops methods to grow, to harvest, and to transport food. You go back to 1700s, 1800s, the person talking about the population growth and the world's going to run out of food in 20 years. You know, they always say in 20 years. Hasn't happened yet. So he learns to build housing that's more comfortable, to use his resources more efficiently. This is what happens as he grows. Built a high rise. And it's, what is the problem? What is all this overcrowding, this terrible stuff that we see going on? Well, the false philosophies. They place artificial burdens on man. That's when the system fails. False religions siphon off needed resources, forbid the use of animals and plants. India suffers because of the sacred cow. I'm not talking about just not eating them. I'm just saying if you shipped them all out of India, there'd be enough grain left over to feed everybody, and there'd be enough left over for them to export. Sacred cows, you can't eat them, can't harm them, and they're eating all every day. It's what's wrong is not overpopulation, it's the religion. Frantic warnings of climate change, pollution, unrealistic care of animals defeat man's rule of earth and complicate his growth. So let's not pay attention to these things. God knows they don't. This is, as soon as you hear them frantically telling us we only have 10, 15, 20 years left on planet Earth. At the end of it, it says, please send in your donation to help us fight this good fight. Yeah? And now we know why it's happening, you see. Perhaps they really believe it. I don't know. But at the time when you go back in history and do it mathematically, you find that the world grows at a fairly small rate because of widespread disease, because of wars, because of natural disasters. These things automatically take care of the so-called overpopulation. Well, let me mention a couple of other things. God created man and animals, created them to eat vegetation. And, you know, there's a problem if you're a vegetable eating person? What do they call it?
Vegetarian.
It was vegetable in there someplace. Vegetarian. There's a problem today because it's hard to get your calcium, it's hard to get your protein, and so on. Not impossible, I guess, but difficult. But God, I just imagine vegetation fresh from creation. How rich was that? How rich was the soil that he had just created? All things made to make this right. And God looking at it saying it's very good. All the bread has long been considered the staff of life. You try living your life eating the white bread from in your Wonder Bread wrapper and drinking a glass of water and see how long you live, you know. You might be well-preserved with all the preservatives, I don't know, but somehow it's supposed to last for a long, long time on the shelf, you know. But homemade bread and that type of thing made with all the natural ingredients, these are things that could sustain life. God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat, and to every beast of the earth, every fowl of the earth, everything that creepeth upon the earth wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat, and it was so. Herbs and trees that produce seed were provided to feed God's creations. Meat here, don't be misled, it's just the generic word for food. At least in the days before the flood, vegetation was sufficient for all the nutritional needs of the hungry. Even today, as you look through the animal kingdom, the animals that regularly eat meat also eat vegetation. The most ferocious carnivore also eats vegetation, especially when they're hungry. Vegetable-eating animals will also eat flesh when they're starving. But we find that during Christ's reign on earth, the animals will again change to their former lifestyle and cease to eat one another. God's ability to control such things seems just a very little thing to him. We would find that well beyond our ability to control. But in the beginning, you didn't kill one another. The animals didn't kill one another. The men didn't need to kill animals. Use them for whatever good they could make, but they would only eat that. Now, after death came, which came by sin, then we find the animals being used, for instance, the skins are used to clothe mankind after sin. But I don't think you can do that without killing the animal. So they began to be used for other things, but they weren't eating them. And let me close with this, that God created all things perfectly. He did it perfectly. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. All before he said it was good. He saw it, and it was good. Here he says it was very good. And the evening and morning were the sixth day. Let me leave you with some quotes. Kylan Dalich says, by the application of the term good to everything that God has made, and he's finished now. Everything that he made, he's made. And the repetition of the word with emphasis, very good, at the close of the whole creation, it demands this, they say, the existence of anything evil in the creation of God is absolutely denied. Nothing evil yet. And the hypothesis, they're talking about somebody's idea, entirely refuted, that the 6 days' work merely subdued and fettered, chained, an ungodly evil principle which had already forced its way into it. Now, he says, there was no evil there. These were not 6 days of creation to overcome some evil. There was no evil in it. You just think about it. The angel that would become Satan, word Satan meaning the enemy, the foe, had not yet fallen into sin. I hear the theologians talking about Satan fell in eternity past. No. Here at the end of the 6 days of creation, he hasn't fallen. Adam and Eve had not yet decided to doubt the love of God. Therefore, death did not occur anywhere on earth. You can't find a gap in there where fossils can be found. You can't have a fossil without death. Romans 5:12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. That God declared everything good means more than that it was merely not evil. I've been emphasizing that. But there's more to it. It was positively pleasant. It was positively agreeable. It was all a good thing and a benefit. This from the very definition of the word good here. Sickness was no threat. Dangerous weather conditions were restrained. No plant was poisonous. These are the conditions that he's dealt with. John Calvin says, the plan wise, the work well executed, the different parts properly arranged, their nature, limits, mode of existence, manner of propagation, habits, mode of sustenance, etc., properly and permanently established and secured. For everything was formed to the utmost perfection of its nature, so that nothing could be added or diminished without encumbering the operations of matter and spirit on the one hand, or rendering them inefficient to the end proposed on the other. And God has so done all these marvelous works as to be glorified in all, by all, and through all. Marvel at his works. Marvel at the efficiency of it. And good old Matthew Henry, he says it's good, and he says it's very good. Good, for it is all agreeable to the mind of the Creator. Good, for it answers the end, the purpose of its creation, to fit the purpose for which it was designed. Good, for it is serviceable to man. And good, for it is all for God's glory. And then, as he talks about the second part, very good, for now man was made, who was the chief of the ways of God, who was designed to be the visible image of the Creator's glory and the mouth of the creation in his praises. And secondly, now all was made, every part was good, but altogether very good. The glory and goodness, the beauty and harmony of God's works, both of providence and grace, as of this creation, will best appear when they are perfected. Wait till the end, and you'll see the final perfection of it all. And at that point, you'll agree with God. Yeah, that was very, very good. Let's bow for prayer. Father, you've given us this picture of, for you, another day of creation. And we run after your thinking. We try to keep up with all that you are doing in this. All of your purposes laid in the creation of man. That little discussion between the persons of the Trinity. Let us make man in our image and our likeness. knowing what it would mean, knowing what would happen, knowing what it would cost God and man, he decided to do it. And we ask, Father, that you might help us to recognize that all things are here. We exist because of your intention to create and your fulfilling of it in such a perfect, good way. With heads bowed, eyes closed, perhaps you'd say, Pastor, I need to revisit my thinking about creation, about evolution, about all these things, and recognize that I'm going to settle on what God says. Let every man be a liar, but God be true. Or perhaps you say, I haven't spent enough time looking around this creation, looking at mankind, and saying, here is that which is worthy of the praise of God. Pray for me. Would you slip your hand up across the building? Pray for me. Father, we bow hearts and minds to thee to recognize you have done that which far beyond man to even understand, much less duplicate. We ask that you might help us then to bow before you in the awe and the glory that comes when we recognize we exist at your will, at the exercise of your power. So we thank you for the Word of God that tells us these things, that shows your intention as well as your accomplishment. And we bow before you. We humbly submit ourselves to thee. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.